are building a path for the peace paradigm. King and Gandhi, many more, have discovered something core. Now we're building a path for the peace paradigm. Every challenge is another highway sign on the path of the peace paradigm. Ooh, 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 ooh.
Welcome, friends, to another episode of Peace Paradigm Radio, radio that explores the power of active nonviolence. And we talk with activists, scholars, practitioners in this great field, this great culture of nonviolence that's happening all around us. I'm your host, Stephanie Van Hook, and I'm here in the studio with my co-host and news anchor, Michael Nagler. Sunday, October 2nd, is Mahatma Gandhi's 147th birthday. So on our show today, we'll be exploring some of Gandhi's life and a bit about his activism. And we're talking today with Veena Howard, and she's assistant professor in the Department of Philosophy at California State University in Fresno. She teaches and researches Asian religious traditions, Mahatma Gandhi's philosophy, animal ethics, interfaith interactions among Hindus and Muslims, and gender issues in Indian philosophy. And she's the author of Gandhi's Ascetic Activism, Renunciation and Social Change, which we'll be talking about today on the show. But she's also translated several books and published articles in professional journals. She's currently editing a book on religions of India, and she's committed to reviving indigenous spiritual and ethical approaches to connect personal transformation and social change. So those of you who have been following our show for a while know that she's really the perfect guest for us today. So welcome, Veena Howard, to Peace Paradigm Radio.
Thank you, Stephanie. I'm happy to be here with you.
And Veena, let's start off by talking about how you got personally interested in the life of M.K. Gandhi. What was it about Gandhi that had you begin this path of research that you're bringing it even into the university and writing books about him?
A great question, Stephanie. So I was born and raised in India, and I grew up listening to the stories of Gandhi. My parents were in part of the India's independence movement, but they were all in the part, lived in part of India, in the western Pakistan, western Punjab, now it has become Pakistan. So after the partition, they were asked to leave now Pakistan to India. And they told us the stories of their trials and tribulations and the stories of Gandhi's movement. So my big brother at that time during the partition was only 6 months old. And so my mother told me that how she carried the little child in her lap and walked so many miles, over maybe 50 kilometers, something like that. And then when I was growing up, we celebrated Gandhi's birthday in schools, and it seemed like Gandhi's face was everywhere. For example, in the postage stamps, in the statues on the street corners or in the... Gandhi's face was everywhere, but we really did not know much about Gandhi other than that he was a Mahatma, he was a great freedom fighter, he brought freedom to India. But then, if you allow me, fast-forwarding several years, when I came for my graduate education to the United States, and I figured out that how Gandhi was very popular in the United States. And so one of the classes at the University of Oregon, one of my colleagues asked me to it was a seminar, adult seminar, to teach with him, and it was on Gandhi. And he asked me to co-teach with him, and I said, well, I don't know a whole lot about Gandhi. And he said, well, you know about Hinduism, you know about the Bhagavad Gita, and you are from India, I think you should co-teach with me. And that was my beginning of my interest. As many of the participants were, 50 plus, and I was quite younger at that time. I was a master's student. I had not started my PhD then. They all got stuck at the episode of Gandhi's Brahmacharya. And when we were reading the autobiography, why would Gandhi practice celibacy? What about his wife? Did he consider her wishes? And, it's kind of a question people ask in scholarship as well. And that was the beginning of my research. So I said, okay, I need to find out what's going on. And I switched my topic for my research, and I chose Gandhi's Brahmacharya and his ascetic activism.
And you said that when you began to research Gandhi's Brahmacharya, you actually ended up finding out that no one had really written about it before.
Yeah, the only way Gandhi's Brahmacharya has been explored, as you know, Eric Erickson's book, and it's more into the calling it celibacy, or in more psychoanalyzing Gandhi's Brahmacharya. The Brahmacharya is used, but it's very in a narrow way that he's controlling his sexual impulses. And maybe something is not right about it. And the question has been asked, that I saw, I read, was what is the relationship between celibacy and political activism? Why do you have to be a celibate, a yogi-like celibacy practicing, and then you're doing political activism? For some reason, that connection was not clear for many of the scholars.
Thank you very much, Veena Howard. This is me, Michael Nagler.
Hi.
Hi, how are you?
Thank you.
We're going to talk extensively about the subject you just raised, but I wanted to interject that I think the problem with understanding Gandhi's Brahmacharya comes from our Freudian background.
Yeah.
And our concept that there are only two alternatives, expression or repression. And we don't understand that there's a middle way of harnessing, of using an energy like that. Has that been your impression also?
Yes, very nicely put. And also the way the sexual control, I mean, you're absolutely right, the Freudian analysis has been used to understand any kind of celibacy that people practice. And either it is dismissed as maybe it's kind of a fad of his own, or the scholars look at his own childhood, that what might have triggered that he, I'm quoting, quote-unquote, he hates sex, or he begins to, move away from sexual engagement. So the idea of Brahmacharya, the way it is described in the Indian tradition and described by himself in great length, is completely is ignored. And I was so surprised. Okay, if he didn't speak about it, then we can say, well, he didn't say very much. We have so much literature on what he himself talks about Brahmacharya, and also the texts he's reading about Brahmacharya in not only Indian literature, all around the world literature. So I'm surprised that scholars would just only take Freudian analysis and to explore Gandhi's Brahmacharya.
We're talking with Veena Howard, who is the author of Gandhi's Ascetic Activism, Renunciation and Social Action, as we celebrate Gandhi's birthday here on Peace Paradigm Radio. And Veena, let's then set the stage for Gandhi taking a vow of Brahmacharya, which wasn't limited to the sexual act as well. The idea of brahmacharya means God conduct, right, or seeking conduct for seeking God. So he's contextualizing himself within a religious tradition. So can we learn a little bit for our listeners about his growing up and why at what point in his life did he end up taking this decision?
Let's look at the historical beginnings of his vow. So Gandhi was married at age 13, and it was arranged marriage, of course. And he does not speak about that experience in a very joyful way. And then he comes to goes to England in 1988 to study law, and then he goes to South Africa in 1893. And he's happily married. He has four children and four boys. And so it's when we look at how I trace the beginning of his vow is 1893, when he is asked to leave the train in South Africa, as a famous episode in the Gandhi film. It's very powerful. When the ticket conductor tells him to leave the train in the first class compartment because he's colored, quote unquote. And Gandhi refuses, and Gandhi is forcefully ejected from the train. And all night long, Gandhi sits on the train station and thinks about what just had happened to him. It's very interesting to see that Gandhi has been, you know, probably is aware of colonial rule. He's probably know about racism, but suddenly his personal experience of this oppression and racism awakens him to something very interesting, very different. He goes next day in the morning to his the colleagues and the businessmen who invited him to come to South Africa, and he narrates them the story, and they just laugh at him. He goes, "So what? Don't travel in the first class compartment." But Gandhi says something needs to be done. But he doesn't know what needs to be done and how it needs to be done. And how I see it, that Gandhi begins to read different kind of texts, different literature, religious literature. He reads, he's exposed to the Bhagavad Gita in England. Then he thinks about the teachings of the Gita. He thinks about the teachings of the Yoga Sutra, which has the five vows: ahimsa, nonviolence, satya, truth, asteya, non-stealing, brahmacharya, which is he calls it control of the all senses, but really generally translated as celibacy or sexual control, and aparigraha, which is non-possessiveness. And also he reads the stories of Ramayana and the Mahabharata, where the yogis, the kings, the saints get power, intangible power, by doing these vows, by practicing these vows. But at least when I traced his writings, he's been thinking about it. He's been thinking about all these alternative ways to fight this war. And in 1906, he goes to, as a stretcher bearer, he assembles a stretcher bearer corps for the Zulu War, where Zulus are suffering and the British are not taking care of them. And in great detail, he talks about how that war experience awakens him to the suffering that is caused by one human to another. Then he says he comes back and he decides to take the vow of brahmacharya. Before that, he said he tries to take the vow, but he fails. But he says he tries to practice brahmacharya, but he fails. But now he takes a vow. So when you take a vow, according to Gandhi, you don't go back. That's it. It's sealed. So he tells his wife, he tells his colleagues, puts in the newspaper on his journal that he's going to take this vow. And that was the beginning of his satyagraha, his passive resistance, and the beginning of our transition from Mohandas to Mahatma.
That's right. So this idea that he would take a vow of brahmacharya as the beginning of his engagement with confronting injustice and the injustice of colonialism and the injustices of racism. So he wasn't taking the vow and then distancing himself from his family or from then the responsibilities that his life had, but he was taking on a whole new life that, in a sense, what were some of his predecessors that he had learned from that you could combine this, you know, religious practice with political engagement as using what you call brahmacharya as a form of a technology of power?
Excellent point. Very good question. So the stories that I see that he's looking at is Bhishma's story in the Mahabharata. And I think some of the listeners can look up, is the grandsire Bhishma, who chooses to take the vow of brahmacharya at a very young age. And that vow, and he's a great warrior, he's a kshatriya, and he goes to battle. And because of his vow of brahmacharya, he's given this boon, this blessing that he can only die when he wishes to die. So Gandhi says, look how he's practicing brahmacharya, and yet he's taking care of the kingly matters. And so he talks about Lakshmana in the Ramayana, and he says for 14 years, Lakshmana took the vow of brahmacharya when he was in exile with Lord Rama. And because of brahmacharya, and I tried to look for the evidence for that. He says that Lakshmana did not sleep for 14 years, and he protected or was with Rama because of his vow of brahmacharya. He didn't need sleep. He was self-sufficient. So he was in a very interesting way looking at the myths. And the critics say that, well, in Indian traditions, either one does renunciation, like a yogi or sannyasa, or one engages in the world, which is pravritti, can be household or taking care of the state affairs. Why is Gandhi combining these two? There's no precedence in Indian traditions. By choosing such stories like Bhishma and Lakshmana, Gandhi is showing, and the yogis, he says that yogis gain powers, and then they use those powers for the good of the humanity. So by using those stories, that he kind of validates, even though the way he does it is very unique, as I say in my book. There is no example of the way he does systematically using the disciplines of Yoga Sutra, the vow of brahmacharya, the vow of ahimsa, the vow of satya, for political activism. The powers that people can use, but not in a systematic way. So Gandhi is innovative in that way.
We are talking with Professor Veena Howard from Cal State University, Fresno, who's authored book, Gandhi's Ascetic Activism. Veena, let me run two observations past you to get your responses. I'm really grateful for the opportunity to be able to do this. He takes those last two yamas from the Yoga Sutras in July of 1906, the non-possession and the brahmacharya, and 3 months later you have this episode, September 11th, 1906, which is the launch of satyagraha in the theater, the Empire Theater in Johannesburg. And that juxtaposition has always seemed very significant to me. Comment on that one first, and let me ask you the other one.
Great. So in his autobiography, Gandhi says, and he writes that right after his chapters on brahmacharya. And he says, the chapter is the birth of satyagraha. He says the vow of brahmacharya had prepared him for this. So he makes a direct connection between his vow and the birth of Satyagraha. It's a very interesting moment in his life. He said he had been thinking about how to, I mean, if you think the timeline, right, it's 1893 when the train episode happened. And now we are in 1906, right? It's almost 13 years. And he's been struggling with the Brahmacharya, and he's been reading about its power, and he says the it now has prepared him to really come up with this creative idea of Satyagraha. So not only that he connects the creativity that arises out of his Brahmacharya vow. So it's not a depression, it's opposite of. So for him, Brahmacharya really holds a lot of creative possibilities. And I think when I can analyze this episode, Brahmachari, by virtue of taking that vow, commits himself or herself to the greater cause by severing the bonds of the family. And that it doesn't mean that you don't take care of them, but the attachment to the family and the aparigraha, which is non-possessiveness, is the, he said that even wife could be your possession. You can, and we know that how we treat our spouse. And he certainly treated his wife like a possession. And he said he freed her, and then he was free and ready to serve the cause. And he says renunciation for action, not from action.
That's perfect, Veena. Thank you. And that does lead me to my next observation I'd like to get your comment on. And that is that both Gandhi and King made a very powerful statement about anger, which again strikes this middle course between repression and expression. Gandhi said that he had learnt the supreme lesson of conserving his anger, which can be turned into a power that can move the world. And King said very similarly, we did not lead to outbursts of anger. We expressed anger under discipline for maximum effect. Now, it seems to me that this is exactly the same dynamic that you're describing that Gandhi goes through with Brahmacharya.
Yes. And I can, if you allow me to quote Gandhi, and he says, anger and intolerance are the enemies of correct understanding. So anger and intolerance are the enemies of correct understanding. And I meditate on this line or this phrase. I think when, according to Gandhi, and anyway, I read it, that anger really, what he calls it, numbs our senses and blinds our mind. In anger, we are not able to see the right and wrong. And that he directly associates anger with violence, because anger and violence are intimately connected. But anger can be sublimated, can be used creatively, but again, it can't stay anger. It channels itself into the creative energy to fight against injustice, rather than using this hatred for the other. It becomes a more like a force, energy, just like Brahmacharya, the force of restraining. It's not just simply for Gandhi, it's restraining the physical act of sex. It is the will to have to satisfy yourself too. So he's more working on the mental level, the inner level, which we forget sometimes. We can be looking very peaceful and not angry and, you know, be physically restrained in our behavior. But what's happening within ourselves, we only know. And it's interesting about Gandhi that we can read what he is feeling inside himself in his journals. And he's constantly checking himself for anger, for sexual desire, or for violence. That's why he says nonviolence, ahimsa is nonviolence in thought, word, and speech. So he does set up a pretty high bar. It's quite interesting to see. And one has to really introspect and see what's happening within. So we can be, you know, apparently peaceful, and, you know, inside we are bubbling with all these negative emotions. And he wants us to look at within first.
Thanks again. Veena, we are getting close to the end. I wonder if you're familiar with Rajmohan Gandhi's biography of his grandfather. He came up with a quote where Gandhi said, if I could master this, this is the end struggle that he's going through in Noakhali, and he's testing his brahmacharya to the utmost. He said, if I can master this, I will have a power to overcome even Jinnah.
It is, and not only I, that sentence I have to look up, but I see that what he says toward the end, if I have mastered the power of Surya, I will have power to change the world. I will have power to make any kind of changes in the world. So it's very interesting to see. And the question can arise, why has he not mastered the Brahmacharya, right? At that time. So we don't know, we'll never find out. But I did write an article on that years when he is experimenting, or I won't use the word experimenting, he calls it sacrifice or yagna with these his niece, Manu. And I think Gandhi's very frustrated at that time when India's partition prospect. And the only thing he sees that maybe he failed within himself, even though he has not had any sexual relationship for, you know, many, many years. Maybe there was something in him that has failed. So I think I would like to push a little bit for one minute. For Gandhi, Brahmacharya is not simply, and I think even Rajmohan Gandhi's book, you know, we have to really pay attention about Brahmacharya for him. Brahmacharya is not simply celibacy, which we generally just say that. Brahmacharya for him is practicing all yamas, all five of them in their entirety, in their perfection. So not just sexual control, but complete nonviolence for your enemy, for Jinnah, for anyone, complete practice of truth, complete practice of asteya, non-stealing, and complete practice of non-possessing. So all five have to be done. So I think that's what he's referring to. I don't think he's just referring to only his sexual control. I think he's referring to any trace of imperfection in his moral disciplines. Does that help with that? Because a lot of time when we say Brahmacharya, we think, oh, maybe he's having sexual thoughts, something like that. But I think he's speaking about, if you look at his earlier work, he's connecting all five disciplines. And he's saying, you cannot practice one without the other four.
Mm-hmm. Now, we're talking with Veena Howard, who's the author of Gandhi's Ascetic Activism, Renunciation and Social Action. And for the first half of the show, we've really just been setting the stage for discussing the effect of Gandhi's vows and renunciations in social action. But I'd like to take some time after our break, Veena, to get into a little bit more about whether these vows are necessary for people today, how we can better understand Gandhi's legacy today. So are you willing to join us for the next part of the show?
Yeah.
And as he walked through riven city and village ablaze, through a miasma of hate, Narsee Bhagat's immortal bhajan, rendered here by M.S. Subbulakshmi, sustained him in the darkest hours.
Vaishnava jana to tene kahiye je peed parai jaane re par dukhe upakar kare to ye man abhiman na para సకల లోకమా సహునే వందే నిందానకరే
Listening to Peace Paradigm Radio. I'm your host, Stephanie Van Hook, and I'm here in the studio with my co-host, Michael Nagler. And we're talking on the celebration of Gandhi's 147th birthday, which is October 2nd. And we're talking to Veena Howard, author of Gandhi's Ascetic Activism, Renunciation and Social Action. Veena, that song was called Vaishnava Janato, and Michael and I were in India a couple years ago to celebrate Gandhi's birthday. Everywhere we went for Gandhi celebrations, that song was sung by children, adults, groups together. And it's a poem by Narsingh Mehta. And do you have a sense of some of the translation of some of the words?
Yeah, you know, the true Vaishnava, the true follower of God is the Pir Parai Janiye, the one who feels the pain of others. I mean, that gives me tears in my eyes. The really is a devotee is the one who feels the pain of others. And the one who helps the Dukh Upakara Karita, who is altruistic, who is compassionate, and who does not have ego, abhimana in their hearts. That is the devotee of God. And so this is just really beautiful and so such a universal song. And also it brings asceticism and activism, the devotion and service to the masses, the saints and politicians together through this song.
I also read somewhere that song was sung when Gandhi picked up the handful of salt on the beach in Dandi after the salt march, that as he went to go pick up the salt, everybody was singing the song, The True Lover of God Feels Others' Pain as its Own, which I thought was so beautifully illustrative of how Gandhi was
reaching. I just love the succinctness and the beauty that really represents his message. That in order to love God, you don't need to renounce the world. You need to love all people. you need to be compassionate to the suffering masses. That is the service of God. And that's why those who are suspicious of Gandhi's, the persona or the combination of saint politician, that is his message, that you, it might seem paradoxical, but you navigate the two without any difficulty. One can be, because he changes the whole idea of God realization. It's not just simply sitting in meditation, it's through karma yoga, through the service of the fellow beings.
In your book, Veena Howard, you mention this on page six, that Gandhi created a coherent native narrative to communicate his strategy of nonviolence. Can you help us to contextualize Gandhi's ascetic practices as strategies to help mobilize the masses to resist the British Empire? Small question.
Thank you. I want to simplify it. So who are the people Gandhi's speaking to? That's the first question. Mm-hmm. Who are the people that Gandhi mobilized? And if we see, Gandhi's followers were primarily Indians. Most of them were from poor backgrounds. Men and women both. Most of them were farmers or did some kind of labor job. And of course, in colonial India, they didn't have too many opportunities for many people. And also, these people were immersed in the India's religious and spiritual traditions. So Gandhi, when he in South Africa, he gives up his lawyer's attire and chooses to wear a peasant's robe, or robe, it's a funny word, attire, or just a dhoti or a little loincloth. He is immediately recognized by people as something different, and they can see him as a saint. They can see him as a Mahatma. They can see him as a someone who is giving up all for public service. So he was, in 1915, he was known as the Bhai Rabindranath Tagore. That's what we, you know, think that he called him first time Mahatma, meaning great soul. So by, he didn't call himself Mahatma. He didn't wear any ochre robes. By virtue of his giving up the whatever colonial way of dressing up, he becomes Mahatma for the masses. And who is Mahatma in this culture? A Mahatma is the one who practices Brahmacharya. Mahatma is the one who lives poorly. Mahatma is the one who takes care of the suffering people. And Gandhi is a lawyer. And Gandhi knows the pulse of people. Gandhi goes to a Kumbh Mela in Haridwar, and he sees the fervor of Indian people, the masses, for religiosity. And very interestingly, he starts to use very religious language, spiritual language, for his movement. He calls his ashram for his communes as ashram. He spiritualizes the whole movement. And he uses, it's a fight, it's a pilgrimage, he called the Salt March. It's a pilgrimage. And he used the language, oh, we want to establish a kingdom of Rama Rajya. He gave examples from Ramayana. He gives examples from the Mahabharata. He gave examples from the Muslim prophet and saint or the teachers. And so he was trying to use the religious language to mobilize people that who were immersed, India's masses who were immersed in religious stories and sacred stories. Even they were, most of them were illiterate, but they were literate in the religious tradition.
Vina Howard, this raises an interesting question for us because we do not live in a culture which is saturated by devotion and religiosity, and yet we feel intuitively that Gandhi's message is for us all. What accommodations or alterations do you think we need to make in order to awaken nonviolence in this country?
That's an excellent question, and I think about a lot, and I leave my presentations many times, invitation to reflect. What myths, what stories, what symbols can move into this masses, right? I mean, that's what your question, I think, is. What kind of language can we use that we can move our masses? And I think the vows that are the moral compass, and I think that people, masses, recognize the truth. Masses recognize simplicity. You know, his the slogan, live simply so that others can simply live, or Gandhi saying the earth provides enough to satisfy every man's need, but not every man's greed. And I think when I put those images and those phrases, those sayings on my PowerPoint or speak, and I think there is this impact happens. So in our secular world, we are still hungry for myths. We still are hungry for narratives. And it may not be, we might have to find narratives which are not religious, perhaps, maybe. Really, I feel that in the moral sense, that the narrative can be resurrected. And when we talk about Mother Earth being, or the globe is held in a child's hand, and what kind of symbolism, what kind of image, what kind of message we get from there. Or when we see a little child crying on a street, hungry or pierced, and what kind of message we get. So I think his principles are universal, and all five principles can be very easily or are can easily translated into Brahmacharya can be just simply self-discipline. And so a non-possession is simplicity. And the truth is integrity. And one can, I think we undermine our people, today's world. I mean, my students surprise me when I teach Gandhi. One of the students took a vow of Brahmacharya without telling me. And he told me after the semester was over, and I was walking on campus, and so he said, Dr. Howard, I've been clean for 2 months. And I said, what do you mean by clean? And he told me, and I didn't know what to say, because, you know, we are teachers, we're professors, and I don't know what to say. And he says, no, I want to talk to you about it. And then he wrote for in a newspaper article for me and had it published. And he said how that vow for, you know, even short periods of time changed his life. And he said his grades got better, and he because he didn't understand the power of self-control. So it's very interesting that these are the, I think, universal virtues, we can call it, the universal disciplines. And each tradition, each culture has models that one can draw on them. I hope this helps, Nigel.
We're talking with Vina Howard, the author of Gandhi's Ascetic Activism, Renunciation, and Social Action. Vina, what's coming up for me in this conversation, especially with Michael's question about the stories that we could be telling in this culture and day and age, what seems like what you're really pointing to is both self-control, and then in your book you talk a lot about Gandhi's devotion and dedication to the ideal of service.
Mm-hmm.
So those aren't necessarily those don't have to have religious connotations. And certainly there's been a lot of debate and discussion in the field of nonviolence, especially around Gandhi's persona about you know, is nonviolence a moral question? Is it, or do you have to be religious in order to be nonviolent? So I think it's a bit tricky because I don't really believe that Gandhi was only using religion to get people to act. I believe that it was something deep that was coming from within. He was having a religious experience. I certainly think so. So I think it creates a certain tension because I'm actually not sure that the ideals that Gandhi spoke of can be achieved without access to that higher part in ourselves. And how can we get that in the kind of culture that we live in that is asking us to turn our senses outward for every sense enjoyment possible?
This is a very good point. So, yes, I want to back up. I didn't mean to suggest that he was just doing to, for the people to mm-hmm. mobilize. Mm-hmm. Of course, he embodied it first. He lived it, and he saw the power of it. But the way he is very systematically does it, and I say that in my book, it's very organically they emerge out of his practices, his activism. Yet, that he knows that how to speak to Indians, because he's an Indian and he's living in an Indian context. And what King does, Dr. King, he does for his Christian context. He teaches, he takes Gandhi's idea of nonviolence and truth force or satyagraha, passive resistance, and uses in his own Christian myths and traditions. So I think that that's how I understood that how the religiosity and the integrity and the truth is not just simply a monopoly of a religion. It is, these are the universal principles, and one can access them through various practices, various traditions, various, you know, spiritual, religious, you know, virtue ethics, different ways that one can embody them. But according to Gandhi, when one embodies them, the people recognize it. It just becomes visible. It just, when one is following the life of integrity, that's like self-discipline, and the devotion to serving others, it becomes like sun. It becomes self-evident. It doesn't need any kind of advertising. But for making into a strategy for mobilizing people, Gandhi had a choice to use the language. So when he used the language, it's a pilgrimage, when he used the word for satyagraha or false satyagraha or many other activities, he was really feeling it that it's not just a simply political activism for him. It is really is a spiritual action for him. So he really combines the two. The masses that were listening to him, they began to, who have not internalized yet the way Gandhi has, the virtues of self-discipline and non-stealing and others, but they are listening to his language, his narrative, and they are moved by that. So it is this sort of an interdependent thing that is happening. And they recognize him that he is giving up all for the service of others, and they join him because they're so moved by Gandhi's charisma and Gandhi's integrity and Gandhi's dedication.
Veena Howard, I have in front of me the book by Eknath Ishwaran called Gandhi the Man, and this is an older version of the book, but on page 105, Ishwaran, who was very interested in Mahatma Gandhi, says, "Activists and scholars have carefully studied what they call, quote, Gandhian politics and Gandhian economics, but few have asked the questions which really count. How did he do it, and from what did he draw his strength? How did an ordinary person end up making such a transformation that he was able, and then here's a statement, to stand and fight alone against the greatest empire the world has known and win without firing a shot?" So that it's quite a statement to make about Gandhi, but what we're looking at is, you know, where he drew his power from. And I think that you are asking that question directly. Where did the power come from? And the ideal of brahmacharya, of control over all of the senses, meaning not negating them, but having actual control over them. You get to decide where you put the energy that comes from the senses. And if the human being is a little pack of energy, when we withdraw our energy from the way that it's leaking out in one of the senses from what we're listening to or watching or touching, or if we're using all of the senses all at once for some reason. When we're able to withdraw ourselves from those experiences, we actually end up gaining power, is what we're saying. And then when we're in control of that, we get to choose where to put it. Right? So helping a Western audience especially understand that this isn't a new idea, that it's been within a tradition that Gandhi grew up in and that he then used within his campaigns is extremely important. And I want Michael to ask his question that he's been here in the studio raising his hand about.
Thank you, Stephanie. I'm kind of jumping up and down on my chair here. it seems to me, and again, Veena Howard, I'd like to get your reaction to this. It seems to me that the way to really make all of this practical for a contemporary audience in the West, in other words, us Americans, is to recognize that these are matters of degree. That you don't like take a vow of strict brahmacharya and then you can begin to be effective. It's a question of looking for small ways in which you can start, as Stephanie was just saying, redirecting that energy. And then when you feel how satisfying that is and how effective it makes you, then you're motivated to increase it. But it's incremental and it's scientific rather than moralistic. That's what I wanted to get your thoughts about.
Very nicely put. I think you brought me to now Gandhi's words. I mean, he called it experiments with truth, right? Gandhi calls it my experiments with truth. And he is experimenting in a very scientific way. And you're absolutely right. It is not, okay, I will do this because I have not taken the vow of brahmacharya or I have not taken this vow. I cannot do this until I do this, right? And that's the wrong way to go about it because it is a transformation. It is a gradual transformation. And Gandhi did not finish it in 1906. Gandhi is working from very early on to when he was early 20s. People forget that he's very young in South Africa. And he continuously works on himself till the last day of his life. And it is not that it's a done project. It is a constant, just like any scientific project, you continue to discover the new possibilities of that situation. And he's continuously experimenting with it, and he's finding the new possibilities. The difference would be that what we read in the scriptures, we read here and there, passages about brahmacharya's power or other disciplines' power. Patanjali talks about the power of nonviolence. He talks about the power that's accrued by brahmacharya is the heroism he talks about, that you get heroism. And I always think about why brahmacharya is with the accrues heroic energy. Because this one is really leaning on or the walk, the conduct of the divine rather than the flesh or the humanly temptations. And it's not hating, it's not, tension within, it's organically and leaning out of and giving yourself to the greater cause. And Gandhi found it in the service of the people. He said, I made service of God, made the service of masses as a way to attain God. Yes. So when one does that, then is following those principles and disciplines, the one are meant to be followed when one is searching God. So for him, it was organic and always, experimenting with and finding its new possibilities.
Thank you so much, Veena Howard, for joining us today on Peace Paradigm Radio, author of Gandhi's Ascetic Activism, Renunciation, and Social Action. Thanks for joining us.
Thank you so much. It's been a pleasure.
We want to thank all of our listeners to Peace Paradigm Radio and all of the volunteers and staff at the Metta Center for Nonviolence. A special thank you to our mother station, KWMR. If you want to have Peace Paradigm Radio on your local station, make sure to talk to your local radio station about that. And until the next time, everybody, take care of one another.